the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Our admonish, draw near, and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 04-1090L, Western Area Power Administration Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Ms. Penick, for petitioner, Western Area Power Administration et al. Mr. Ryder, for petitioner, Sacramento Municipal Utility District et al. Ms. AOC, for petitioner, Energy Producing User, Mr. Soto, for respondent and respondent of the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mark Penick, United States Department of Justice. For purposes of argument today, I represent Western Area Power Administration and the other existing customers on, and I would like to address the court on issues 1 and 2, which are the Sierra Mobile issues. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for my time. Mr. Ryder will address the court on issue 3, which is the behind the meter. And Mr. Aoki will address the court on behalf of the co-generator petitioners. Following Mr. Ryder. I don't have much time, so I will get right to the point. Existing customers are paying twice for the same thing. Unlike East Kentucky, we have a situation here where the California ISO has assumed all of the controller area responsibilities that were previously performed by PG&E under the existing contracts with each of the existing customers. PG&E is not disputed in this case. There's no conflict in the evidence. There's no dispute on the law. That as a matter of law and as a matter of fact, PG&E stopped providing those services when the ISO was created, and the ISO then assumed responsibility for providing all the control area services, all the MO market operation services that we are now being charged with under PG&E's pass-through tariff. In that situation, which is different again than East Kentucky, where that did not occur, we have a situation where the existing customers are paying twice for the services and get none of the benefits from PG&E that PG&E was obligated to provide. PG&E is enjoying the consideration provided by those services, by that contract, from each of the existing customers, and providing none of the services or incurring none of the costs that it was obligated to incur. A simple example will illustrate the point. Under Western's contract 2948A, which this court considered, by the way, in its 2003 decision, PG&E versus FERC. Under that contract, PG&E was obligated to buy and sell electricity in order to perform the load sharing obligations that PG&E assumed under that contract. That included, by the way, exactly the purchases that required to account for imbalanced energy and supplementary energy, which were components of the MO costs, the market operation costs, that are now being passed on through the pass-through tariff that ISO bears. Under that contract, 2948A, that's part of the consideration that PG&E enjoyed by virtue of sharing the load and getting the benefit of the power generated by Western, was it would make those purchases, and Western didn't have to pay a dime. Now, Western is being charged for every single time that PG&E performs that obligation, which didn't go away, it still exists. Well, not currently, but it existed after the creation of the ISO. Every time PG&E did that, it was being charged under the pass-through tariff under the MO charges that the ISO imposed. It is simply impossible to say in these circumstances where the ISO has assumed all the obligations that PG&E previously had for the control area services and the MO services, that in the words of this court in East Kentucky, that it did not modify the rates, terms, and conditions of services provided under these contracts. Of course it has. How could it not have modified those provisions? Western is now paying for costs it did not pay for, but were assumed within the contract it had. Each of the other existing customers are paying costs different than for the same services that it didn't pay before or paid differently before. This has modified those agreements fundamentally, so that there is really no dispute in this case that, in fact, the same services are provided. FERC cannot change that result by sprinkling fairy dust on it and saying that the ISO is new, therefore everything the ISO does is new. It's simply not true. One, there's no evidence that the ISO performs anything that's new. There's no evidence that it performs what PG&E did better than PG&E did. It's the CAS element of this is to perform safe and reliable services or transmission services for this power. That's exactly the obligation that PG&E had, and the commission acknowledged it in its opinion in paragraph 51. There's firm power. There's no more firm power being delivered here. The transmission obligation is identical. What's changed is that PG&E pockets the consideration provided under these contracts and provides none of the services that it was obligated to provide under these contracts. It has there, FERC has permitted PG&E to pass through the ISO charges directly to the existing contracts without any analysis of the contracts or without any analysis of whether or not there's anything that's being substituted that's new. It's almost like a talismanic invocation. ISO is new, therefore everything the ISO does is new. That's not the law. It's worse. Each of the contracts that are at issue here, with the exception maybe of one, but ones we've cited to, have provisions in them, and this court addressed Westerns, and again in the 2003 opinion, where actually limit the right of PG&E to impose unilateral changes. We made this point to PG&E and to FERC in the proceedings below, and FERC ignored these provisions. These provisions are no less entitled to Sierra Mobile protection than any other provision.
Could you tell me what page in the joint appendix is provision that you're referring to?
Your Honor, they were cited in our reply brief, and in a footnote where we cite every one of these provisions.
Why don't you cite me the best one for you?
I think that would probably be Smud's reference to that, and that's really quite clear.
Could you turn that page and tell me what language you're referring to? I'm talking about JA 1402.
The very first paragraph, Your Honor, except as may be expressly provided in this agreement, nothing herein should be construed as infecting. I would like to look again at the pages we cite. I'm not sure we cite to that page. Yes, there we
go. You said it says that there's an agreement that no new charges will be added. I'm just looking for where that language is.
Well, what's in there is provisions in the contract to say you have to take certain steps.
You said that the provision provides that no new charges can be added. That's what I'm looking for.
Each of the language of each of these contracts is different.
Let's start with the SMUD one and tell me the language that you're referring to.
It is JA 537 to 539, Your Honor, where we raise this point in our petition. And I would actually like to defer to Mr. Ryder on this because he's Smud's client on this and knows more about Smud's contract than I do. But I can address that point on the Western's contract for you because
Did you say, J 539?
Well, it was raised 537 to 539.
I'm not saying it wasn't raised. I just want to.
Let me address then a Western's contract because that was at issue in 2003 decision.
What page is that on?
This court held.
What page is that on? In the joint of, I'm looking for the language that you're referring to, that's all.
That's Article 32 of Western's contract 2948A. And you need look no further than this court's opinion on page 250 of the PG&E versus FERC decision, where this court held that
Can you tell me the joint appendix page where I can find it?
I can't offhand, Your Honor.
After you sit down, maybe you can look for it.
Yes, sir. Okay. The court held that provision, 32, 2948A impose a condition precedent on the right of PG&E to make unilateral changes.
Before you sit down, Mr. Pinnick, I want to make a comment. I'm speaking only for myself now, but I found your brief unreadable. 50 acronyms? You've got existing customers are ECs, and GMC is not General Motors, it's something else. And I read sentences like this: FERC denied all rehearing requests regarding its approval of CAISO's CAGI allocation methodology for CAS charges, as well as challenges to approval of CAISO's MO tariff and PG&E's PTT tariff. In order for anybody to understand that sentence, they have to have memorized every single one of those acronyms. Those acronyms are for the convenience of the writer, but they are not for the convenience of the reader. And I think it's more important that the reader's convenience be taken into account if what you're trying to do is persuade. And if you compare your brief with the one that FERC wrote, you'll see a huge difference. I think that there's a half a page of acronyms in FERC's brief.
No, no,
so
I...
for the future, 50 is just over the top. It's impossible for anybody to understand this brief without sitting down and memorizing it, which I'm not going to do.
I don't blame you, Your Honor. It's indigenous to this energy law area. And
I read the, or didn't read it all, but I looked at the ALJ's opinion. It's the same way.
It's almost part and partial of this practice. I take a court's admonishment.
That's because you're doing that day in and day out. And when you say MO, you don't mean method of operation or modus operandi. You mean something else. But when I see MO and I see ID and I see GMC, all those acronyms mean something different to me.
I take the court's admonishment. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you sit down, could you tell me that site to the Western case that you were referring to?
That's surely, Your Honor. That's PG&E versus FERC. That's, I believe, 3, it's in the brief here. F3, 243. It's referred to in our reply brief on pages 15 and 19.
Okay, thank you.
And in our opening brief as well. The whole thing there was simply that there was a condition preceding to unilateral changes. I thank the court for its time.
May it please the court, Harvey Ryder on behalf of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve a minute of my time for rebuttal. The court need not reach the issue of the behind-the-meter exemption if it finds either that the California ISO was not providing new services to existing customers.
I'm going to bring that down, but I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. That it was not providing new services to existing customers, or that the existing contracts between PG&E and the customers barred PG&E from adding new services unilaterally. But in this case, the commission correctly concludes that if a customer does not cause the ISO to incur control area service charges, then that customer should be exempt from those costs. They should be exempt from those charges. The problem is, I think, illustrated by the petitioner intervener brief in support of the intervener brief in support of FERC, which explains where the ISO and why the ISO would incur control area costs. It says at page 34 of that brief that the ISO directly incurs costs for behind-the-meter load in connection with all control area services that are, quote, directed toward ensuring that load continues to be served, close quote, and that's at page 24. Well, logically, if the customer has assumed full responsibility for meeting the reliability in its service area, that's a responsibility the ISO no longer has or never had should logically have no reason to incur costs to meet that obligation. It's the customer's responsibility. There's no dispute in this record, in fact, that the customers have assumed that responsibility. And with regard to Silicon Valley, for example, the ISO admitted that it has no responsibility, and that, to use the ISO's words, Silicon Valley has the whole responsibility for its load. Same thing goes with respect to SMUD. the ISO's witness stated, for example, that SMUD, which operates the non-reliability must-run, and I'm avoiding the RMR acronym, units were, quote, assumed to be online when needed for local reliability purposes. That's a joint appendix 433. And a page later, an ISO witness says that the ISO, quote, relies on SMUD to ensure local reliability in its area. Well, logically, if the ISO is assuming that SMUD is taking care of that, it's not a responsibility for which the ISO has to plan. The commission, however, concludes that all of that's irrelevant. It says that it doesn't matter whether the customer assumes full responsibility or not. What matters is that the customer's generation shows up on a list of the power flow studies provided by PG&E to the ISO. Well, the record shows that the generation that's modeled is virtually every generator in the western half of the United States. It's an illogical test. The commission's objective was to identify those customers that do not cause the ISO to incur control area costs, but the test doesn't do that. In fact, on the eve of the formation of the ISO, it sends a letter to SMUD. And in that letter, it says, this is the last day of 1997, it says, quote, SMUD will be assessed the GMC, that's the grid management charge, that encompasses the control area services charge at issue here, only for the amount of power delivered to or transported from the SMUD service area, an arrangement that would, quote, unquote, net out the substantial amount of load served by generation in SMUD's service area. Well, logically, if the ISO is expecting to incur substantial costs to provide control area service to SMUD, why would it tell SMUD, don't expect to pay anything? The commission ignores that and simply says that a factor like that is irrelevant. I think that's the commission's conclusion. It's the test it devised was simply arbitrary. And if the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, Wada Oki appearing today for the Cogeneration Association of California and the Energy Producers and Users Coalition. With the court's approval, I would like to reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. Just briefly, CAC and EPUC are industrial facilities that have installed cogeneration both to supply their thermal energy needs as well as to serve on-site electrical load. When the on-site generation is serving the on-site load, they are operating behind the meter, are unseen by the ISO and are not utilizing the ISO grid. When they require additional generation or if their cogeneration facility is offline, then they purchase energy from their interconnected utility at tariffed retail, standby, or industrial rates. And when they do that, they pay their appropriate share of the grid management charge. The heart of this case for the cogenerators is obviously the allocation of the ISO's control area services charge. We would submit that the commission had a choice here or could have adopted an exemption that was based upon the record evidence that was consistent with cost causation principles and which was non-discriminatory. Instead, they created four separate standards for exemption which were not based upon record evidence and which then the commission had to go out and seek evidence to support those exemptions. We would submit that there's only one exemption that is founded upon the record evidence, and that is the original exemption based upon the 2001 hearing that the commission set forth in opinion number 463. And there they said that customers with behind-the-meter generation who primarily rely upon that generation to meet their energy needs are allocated too great a share of the control area services cost under the gross load billing determinant and therefore should be billed on a basis other than gross load. And in the November 16, 2004 order, the commission clarified that that basis should be net load, net of
use on-site. Can I just pause for a second on the jurisdictional question?
Yes.
So you didn't file a petition for rehearing from C, a petition for review from C. You applied from the denial of your petition for rehearing, right?
That's correct.
And by that time, it was too late to specifically apply with respect to C, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so the only thing that you are appealing from is the denial of your petition for rehearing, right?
Actually, we filed for a rehearing of C because the standard for exemption contained in opinion 463C differed from 463B.
Right, but the I understand your argument, but the FERC said, no, we're just not going to rehear it. That's all they said, right? Well, under Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, the Supreme Court opinion, when an agency says we're just not going to rehear it, we don't have jurisdiction to review the rehearing decision. So, and you're too late to review the other one. So how do we get to hear your argument?
I believe that we filed a petition for review of all of the commission's opinions,
but
we filed for timely rehearing
of
all of those.
You filed too late, though, right?
We filed to preserve our appellate rights of the entire series of opinions leading up to the final order rejecting. At that time, we wanted to afford FERC the opportunity to correct what we saw was an increase in the standard for exemption.
Right, but we have a jurisdictional window. Whether you're being nice to FERC or not, it doesn't help us any, and it doesn't help you any. If you file too late, you file too late, and I'm not understanding how we're able to get to your argument.
Well, when we filed for rehearing from opinion 463B, and that was on a specific standard, and the commission came forward with opinion 463C and reiterated a different standard, we didn't feel that at that point we could take the petition to this court because the issue had not been resolved. It was still live. They had changed the standard, and we were required to file a subsequent motion for reconsideration, both to bring that error to the commission's attention as well as to preserve that issue for appeal because it did set a different standard. So we would submit that the time for filing began at that point after denial of the rehearing of opinion number 463C.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. In speaking about that, the one single exemption which is set forth in 463, and as we articulate in our papers, rather than adopting that exemption, the commission went forward with four separate standards for exemption, none of which are based, in many cases by their own admission, on record evidence. The result of that is that the retail behind the meter load customers that presented evidence upon which the commission determined that these customers should be billed on other than a gross load basis due to their more limited impact on the grid are being billed on a gross load basis, and their more limited impact on the ISO grid is being ignored. And with that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to start with Judge Garland's question. The place in the JA where the Western Area Power Administration discusses its Mobile Sierra claim, pages 436 and 437. What WAPA, the Western Area Power Administration, argues there is that these are strictly services under the contract and you can't change the contract. The commission responded to that in detail in 463 and 463A. And far from sprinkling fairy dust on it, this is based on precedent. This court recognized in the Midwest Transmission Owners case that the cost of having an ISO, that would be the administrative costs that go into that, that's different from the cost of using an ISO, which would be the transmission rates. The control area services customers are paying their transmission rates under their contracts during this limited period. But the cost of having an ISO, as the Midwest Transmission Owners Court recognized, is different. East Kentucky was the next stage. We have both cases in the same case here. In East Kentucky, the question was, could the cost be passed through? And the court affirmed the commission that, yes, indeed, these administrative costs could be passed through to existing contract customers. They were called grandfathered customers in that case. Here they're called existing contract customers. The concept's exactly the same. In terms of Mobile Sierra, the court looked at that in East Kentucky, the exact same argument that's raised here, and said the Mobile Sierra doctrine, powerful though it may be when it does apply, doesn't apply here because these are new services that are supplied by the ISO that nobody else can supply. Now, it's plenty of evidence about that. 463, opinion 463, especially at page 347 of the JA, talks about the overarching costs of maintaining a reliable and efficient control area. Only the ISO is the control area operator for this new great control area. The individual transmission owners only control their service territories, which is a completely different situation from the way it was before the ISO. So I don't think they can blinker their eyes and say, no, we're not getting new services, when it's already been established that having an ISO gives you various benefits, so you have a more reliable, more efficient grid. And the two elements of the grid management cost here, the control area services and the market operations, go to that. The control area services costs, things like security studies, the things that actually go to the helping the unified grid operate. The market operations cost, it's for the cost of having a market for ancillary services and imbalance energy. There's no double charging here, and the commission specifically addressed that. The Mr. Bray and Mr. Duran, two PG&E witnesses.
Is it reasonable to assess market operations charges on firms that self-provide ancillary services?
It provides the ancillary services. Well, first of all, under the billing determinant, I think the petitioners confused this. The control area services is a gross load billing determinant with one exception, which we can talk about. But the market operations charge, you don't pay if you're self-providing.
Well, they seem to feel like it is being passed through.
As we said in the in 463A in particular, and it's at I think JA 343, based on testimony of Mr. Lyon, that is just not the case. The way the tariff is set up, if you self-provide, this billing determinant does not attach. This billing determinant is a pay-as-you-go, unlike the control area services billing determinant, which is assessed to all load.
That's what the commission said.
That's what the commission said, and that's what the tariff says.
No, I'm not asking what the tariff says. There seems to be a disconnection between the two. They're making an assertion. As I read it, the commission is, according to them, is simply giving lip service to this, but in fact they are still being charged on the pass-through.
Well, first of all, the costs we're talking about here are the cost of administering the market for ancillary services. That's not even a cost that could be charged under their contracts. It didn't exist before the ISO. But the cost, actually, the billing determinant, the cost is not added if they're not actually procuring services from the ISO. So they're not paying if they don't use it. They're just factually wrong about that. We believe the gross load allocation was reasonable. There's certainly a lot of evidence here that all load, all generators benefit. I think the commission could have actually stopped there and it would have been affirmable, but it tried to craft an exception. It did have some trouble setting out this exception. First talked about behind the meter. Then on rehearing, it was clear that wasn't going to work. So the commission developed this modeling exception. If something studied or modeled, then it wouldn't incur control area services if it's not studied or modeled. Well, on rehearing, it was clear that there was no record for that. So I think what the commission did was an exemplary thing for an administrative agency to do. It set the matter for hearing to see what kind of record would develop. And the record that developed showed, yeah, there was a scope for a small exemption, that there are certain generators that are not studied or modeled, and when those don't incur control area services, those won't have to pay the charge when they're not using the grid. It's a reasonable result, and it's
what do you say? So SMUD says they don't use the system. Why should they pay any costs?
SMUD uses the system. Everybody uses the ISO control area services. These are services that could not be provided by SMUD. These are control area services. SMUD cannot self-provide them. To the extent SMUD is self-providing ancillary services, it's not paying for it, but that's the other part of the charge.
Well, what about his analogy, not SMUD provided, but for Silicon Valley? Somebody else is providing those, everything in Silicon Valley. He claims not relying at all on the ISO.
Well, as the court recognized in the Midwest transmission users and the commission recognized here, when you have an ISO, you do get benefits. There are things that only the ISO can do, that the reliable operation of the transmission grid with security analysis, emergency management, outage coordination, transmission planning, it can only happen on a control area-wide basis. The control area operator is the ISO, nobody else. These are all, everybody else is within the ISO control area. And the reliability question is very important because it's the ISO that reports to the Western Area Coordinating Council.
Well, what are the, maybe you could flesh out what the burdens are, what burdens are imposed on the ISO when it models something, even if the modeler normally doesn't use the system, even if the entity modeled doesn't usually use the system.
Well, it's studying the, just because something's using the system or not doesn't mean it doesn't have to be studied to make sure that the ISO has a reliable backup system, for example. The ISO has to study.
So, for example, although normally they wouldn't use it, if there were an emergency shutdown or something, they would have to use it? Is
exactly.
That what you're saying?
Exactly. And there's testimony about that from Mr. Gross, the staff witness that the commission relied on. And JA 1347-48 and JA 1320, he talks about that specific issue and says, yeah, it doesn't matter if it's on or off. It has to be studied, and that does incur costs for the ISO. As far as the jurisdiction goes, commission established the studying standard, the modeling and studying standard in the 463B opinion. There were a lot of requests for rehearing. In 463C, we denied rehearing. All petitioners appealed, except for the COGEN petitioners, who asked for a rehearing of a rehearing, which the commission reasonably rejected.
Back on the Mobile Sierra question, do any of the contracts say, as opposing counsel says they say, that no additional charges can be added?
No additional charges for the rate under.
No, I'm sorry, no additional services can be added.
I don't think so. First of all, I don't think that argument was really raised on rehearing.
Yeah, assuming that it was.
Assuming that it was, I don't think any of the contracts say that. The administrative law judge went through them quite carefully, and we did affirm her. And it's a very novel concept under Mobile Sierra to argue that new services can be excluded from a contract. I don't know of any case law that applies Mobile Sierra in that situation. If you look at the language, particularly in East Kentucky, that's the distinction that the court makes. When it says, well, yeah, you'd say you can't have new terms and conditions for your service, but if it's a new
Mobile
service.
Mobile Sierra talks about rates and contract terms. So what if the
rates and contract terms within that contract.
So what if you had a contract that said, these are going to be the rates for the next 20 years, and no new services will be added without the approval of both parties?
Well, the commission's case law, and I think this court has also said, if it's a new service, we're not in Mobile Sierra territory.
But none of, as they point out, and you point out the same thing by calling it novel, we haven't seen a contract like that before.
I'm not sure the commission would approve a contract like that based on the commission's precedent.
So you're saying, what you really are saying is there is no contract like that here.
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any contract like that here. I don't think there's any contract like that generally. I'm not sure the commission would approve that contract because of the case law cited in opinion 463 on this issue.
Isn't PG&E passing through the market operation charge for ancillary services where the customers self-provide and purchase supplemental or imbalance energy?
It's only passing it through when the market operation.
Yes, on that. And the ALJ said she couldn't comprehend that, and the commission doesn't answer it.
Well, the commission does answer,
so
Your Honor.
Your brief characterizes what you think is the answer, but the commission doesn't. And I'm talking about that specific set.
The
Market operation charges and firms that self-provide ancillary services, and they also sell or buy supplemental and imbalance energy.
But the judge apparently didn't.
No, answer that question.
Did
the commission explain how that can be so?
The commission does not believe that's the fact.
Where did they say that?
463A, JA 595, I think, is where we discussed it. So,
where did the commission say that fact is wrong, that there is no fact set of that sort?
What it said was, sorry. In paragraph 42, which is JA 595, says the question you're asking, it says the ISO tariff itself indicates the MO charge is only assessed on a scheduling coordinator when it procures such services through the ISO markets, and it's not, this tariff further provides that the coordinator's responsibility for those costs is reduced by other self-provided ancillary services. In sum, the party's claim of being charged twice for the same service cannot be sustained. So the commission.
Answer my question. I gave the specific set, not just the ancillary services. I said where they're also sell or buy supplemental or imbalance energy. And they're contending that the commission just hasn't addressed it. The ALJ did not agree with the commission on this. The ALJ was not upheld. Said PG&E has not adequately or persuasively explained why its customers should be assessed the ISO MO charges, which are based on costs allegedly incurred by the ISO to arrange for provision of ancillary services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think generally,
if the answer is as it appears, the commission didn't address it, just say that. But you're not pointing me to anything that addresses what I'm talking about.
I don't think the commission dealt with ancillary services and imbalance energy separately, because under 888, it generally sees those imbalance energy is an ancillary service. So it wasn't really thinking in those terms. These parties defined it slightly differently. But the concept that you're talking about, I believe, was addressed in the paragraph I cited.
If in 463C the commission had issued a, quote, new order, would the co-generator's petition for judicial review be timely?
If they had issued a new order with a new result and discussed the merits.
Yeah, it would be. But why are they wrong with respect to the argument that the commission, in fact, did issue a new order?
Well, the commission said that we have.
In C.
In B, it talked about modeling and studying and used the terms pretty much synonymously. In C, it said the same thing. It was answering a lot of claims by the petitioners, and it said, no, this is, most of them said, no, let's expand this exemption. No, this isn't what you meant to start with. And the commission said, no, we're giving you the same exemption. We understand it's not what you want. We understand it's a lot less, more limited in scope than what you would ask for, but this is the same exemption. And the other petitioners understood that and appealed. And we didn't move to dismiss it. Case was ready for review. Thank you.
JA 1210 in the PG&E tariff treats imbalance energy in addition to ancillary services.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, what page are you on?
Imbalance energy in addition to the ancillary services.
But what page is it?
1210.
Oh, that's in the pass-through tariff. Yes, that's true. What I'm saying is that the commission, in reviewing this, was essentially including imbalance energy within the ancillary service rubric, because in 888, the commission, when it lists its ancillary services, one of them is imbalance energy. So it wasn't really distinguishing, but the principle applies.
I don't see it, but okay.
If there are no further questions, thank you.
Good morning. On behalf of the interveners supporting, may it please the court, on behalf of the interveners supporting the respondent FERC, I would first like to address Justice Garland's questions regarding.
Thank you for the promotion.
Sorry, Judge Garland's question. Maybe someday. Judge Garland's question about whether any of the contracts at issue in this case prohibited PG&E from charging a new charge for a new service. And the answer is no, they don't. To take as one example, the petitioner's own example of the SMUD interconnection agreement, that can be found at pages 1404 to 05 of the joint appendix. If you read section 10.29, which is what petitioners point to, that is only a boilerplate integration clause, which says only that it constitutes the entire agreement between the parties and cannot be amended without the joint written consent of both parties. But the Commission's decision that PG&E's pass-through tariff is a new service and not an amendment to the contracts is a fatal flaw in the petitioner's argument. The same can be said for the other contracts at issue in this case. I won't go through them individually, but NCPA's contractual provision can be found at page 1170 of the joint appendix, and SVP's contractual provision can be found at page 1520 of the joint appendix. And if the court reads those provisions, it will see that they only prohibited amending the terms and conditions and rates of the contract. They didn't say anything about new services and new charges.
Well,
and
under the integration clause means you can't add anything to our obligation unless both sides agree.
But
it's such an amusing argument to me that people say integration clauses are just, I don't know what. They obviously have meaning. If you and I cut a deal and it says A, B, and C, it means I'm not going to pay for D, E. I don't care whether it's new or not unless I agree to it. That's the argument.
Well,
if I haven't agreed to add D, I'm not accepting those terms. You and I have to talk about it. That's what an integration clause means, at least in the labor context. That's what it means, and it's well understood. You can't make a new deal merely by saying I insist that you take something that I'm calling new.
I think what the integration clause means is that this is the entire agreement with respect to the charges and terms that are in that agreement, and I agree that PG&E could not have changed, for example, the rates for
the contract is you're obliging me to do something more than I've agreed to do. That's
with
changing
with respect to those services.
With respect to anything, if you and I have a deal and it only covers four things, and now you want to charge me for seven things, that's creating a contractual obligation, right?
You're
saying I'm now obliged to do that.
Yes, with respect to the bundle of services and benefits that are in that agreement, but I don't think that it would be prudent to enter into an agreement that would prohibit a utility from filing a new tariff for new charges for new services that are not contemplated under the agreement because they could not have been contemplated under the agreement. The ISO didn't even exist.
If Judge Edwards' question, if the answer were yes, then East Kentucky would be wrong, right? That opinion would have just been decided wrongly.
Yes, I believe that East Kentucky is on all fours with the situation.
Well, it's on all fours if there is a distinction between an agreement about certain rates or about certain terms on the one hand, an agreement not to add any other new services on the other. If there isn't that distinction, then East Kentucky is simply wrong. Since we don't have the power to overrule it, I think you can rest happy on the assumption that it's not wrong, at least for purposes of this opinion. This integration clause, as I read it, just says that any other pieces of paper that might be out there are all subsumed into this piece of paper, and that you can't look at any previous pieces of paper that we had, any interim agreements, anything else, in order to form the agreement. Isn't that what it means by no representations, covenants, or other matters, oral or written, which are not set forth here or incorporated herein?
Yes, I agree. That's what it means. And, you know, you find that in almost all contracts, a boilerplate clause like that.
Now, they contend that PG&E originally agreed that it already provided all the services and has now changed its position. What's the answer to that?
I don't think that PG&E ever conceded that it what PG&E said was, we did provide reliable, firm transmission service under the agreements. But once the ISO took over operational control of the former utilities control areas, it became a whole different world. And the ISO, as control area operator, did provide new services that PG&E and the other participating transmission owners could not provide, and that no other market participant could self-provide. And I see that my time is up, so unless the panel has any further questions for me, that completes my argument. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you're out of time, but we'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Garland, I want to respond precisely to your question. On the PG&E versus FERC case in the 2003 decision of this court, it involved Article 32 of the of Western's contract at issue here.
Is that article in the joint appendix?
I'm sorry?
Is that article in the joint appendix?
In fact, it is the joint appendix. I don't have a jump site to that Article 32 right now. But it's a quote in the opinion itself on page 250. And this court construed the very language set forth in that Article 32, and I quote, we agree with the ALJ that the language imposes a condition precedent to new transmission rates. Now, let's keep in mind the new transmission rates.
New transmission rates, right?
The new transmission
rates. Not new services.
Your Honor, the new transmission rates at issue in that very case are the GMC charges right here. They include it, and didn't include everything, but include at least the grid management charges right out here. On remand from that decision, PG&E voluntarily dismissed out the GMC portion of that. This was a case where GMC was attempting to recover the PG&E was attempting to recover the grid management costs under the contract, which we think they ought to be doing if they're seeking to do anything, relying on their contractual remedies. Instead of doing that on remand from this court's decision, where this court said that this clause imposed a condition preceding that was entitled to Sierra Mobile protection, they dropped that off and so that they could pursue this litigation. So that they could seek to pass through those costs that they dropped out of that contractual litigation by asking for the FERC to approve those costs in a pass-through situation.
We didn't decide the condition precedent argument in East Kentucky, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We did not. It wasn't presented. You can search that opinion to your blue in the face and not see it.
I understand the language you said is the language that says, if the parties are unable to agree on a change of any rate or charge, the matter shall be submitted to the Federal Power Commission. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. The Article 32
I'm reading
imposes
Article
a joint review provision on the parties.
Right.
Before FERC can do that.
I'm reading you Article 32 right now from my handy Westlaw. And it says, such review shall take into account substantial savings. If the parties are unable to agree on a change of any rate or charge, the matter shall be submitted to the Federal Power Commission.
Your Honor, the question presented in PG&E was whether the PG&E had in fact complied with the joint review provisions by meeting with Western sufficiently to satisfy that.
Well, there isn't any doubt that the parties are unable to agree here, all right?
No, Your Honor.
And there's no doubt that it was then submitted to the Commission.
No, Your Honor. The question presented was not that. The question presented was if PG&E had in fact done sufficient efforts to satisfy that condition preceding. That was the very question that this court remanded back to FERC to resolve. That was then when upon that remand to see what PG&E had done and whether that was sufficient was then that's when GMC charges were dropped out of the case and proceeded on other things.
Can you tell me where, what page I'll find the condition precedent argument?
Page 250, Your Honor.
No, in your, I have 250 right here, in your brief.
Oh, in our brief, certainly.
We quote PG&E in this very point on pages, in our reply brief especially, but in our opening brief as well. On page 15 of our reply brief, we quote it. On page 19 of our reply brief, we cite to it. On page 19 of the reply brief, neither FERC nor interveners discuss these contractual provisions, which plainly bar unilateral additions, C, E, G, P, G, and E, discussing conditions preceding to changes contained in Article 32 of Western Contract 2948A. The issue is plainly raised. It's not like it's new to FERC. FERC, this court should not be doing this itself. This is FERC's job. It is FERC's job to look at these contracts and determine whether or not these, in fact, are covered by the existing services that PG&E was obligated to provide. There's no doubt that ISO is performing the same thing to some extent that PG&E was obligated to provide, because PG&E simply stopped providing those services at all because it couldn't under the law. It has admitted that it no longer provided the control area services. It's admitted it provided the and that ISO have performed those services. This is not a situation where it's brand new, and there's no attempt to parse that out. My time is way past. I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you.
Round it off in 1 minute each.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quick points. With respect to the exemption, the Commission has said that everybody benefits from having an ISO, but in this case, the Commission has expressly eschewed the notion that it should apply a benefits test for purposes of defining which customers are entitled to an exemption. In fact, at FERC's brief at page 21, it cites opinion 463 to say that it rejected the judge's conclusion that the exemption should be related to how much the customer benefits from receiving a control area service. With respect to the argument that somehow if a customer's generation goes offline, the ISO has to incur any cost for planning for that, it's certainly true that when generation goes offline, there's an automatic electrical response. As the record shows at page 289 of the Joint Appendix, any activity on the interstate grid affects the rest of the grid, but that doesn't mean that the ISO is incurring any cost to plan for it. On the contrary, the ISO admitted, and this is in the Commission's record, with respect to Silicon Valley assumed full responsibility for its load. That's not partial responsibility or partial responsibility some of the time. Same with respect to SMUD. The record shows that the ISO assumed that SMUD's generation was always on. Even though it's possible that a generator could go out and there'd be an electrical response, it can go in both directions. The Supreme Court's decision in New York versus FERC describes that quite well. If generation in the SMUD controller has an outage, there'll be a response from SMUD generation. That doesn't mean the ISO is incurring costs to plan for that contingency. In fact, the record shows it's assuming just to the contrary. I see that my time is up, unless the court has any questions.
If SMUD's generation went out and power had to come from somewhere else, no cost at all to transferring the power?
No
cost to foreseeing what to do under those circumstances?
No, Your Honor, because the ISO assumes that this is what the ISO said. It's assuming that full responsibility is SMUD. There's severe penalties on SMUD if it fails to live up to its obligations. Now, do contingencies occur in any electrical system? Of course.
And do they have to plan for the contingency?
No, and no more than they would have to plan for the contingency that there's a generator that would go out in Colorado or in the state of Washington. They don't plan for that. They plan to meet their own load.
So the modeling is just totally useless?
Oh, no, of course not, Your Honor. There is modeling, for example, that's done with respect to reliability must-run generation. And the record shows that the ISO incurs costs. It acquires those contracts. It has to manage those. But SMUD has no RMR contracts, or no RMR generation, neither do the other petitioners. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Randolph, in answer to a question which you posed about the jurisdictional issue, FERC counsel mentioned, in effect, as I heard, that opinion 463 just rejected the rehearing request of opinion 463B, and the standard was essentially unchanged. And again, as we articulate in our papers, the standard did change. It gave rise to a wholly new objection because it went from generators that are in utility models to generators that are in utility models and studies, and furthermore added the subjective standard that if the ISO takes any information regarding those models and studies and determines that it's relevant at all, then that generator is not entitled to the exemption. In other words, the charges apply. And that was a change in the standard that we believe warranted us exhausting our administrative remedies before the commission, before bringing that issue to the court. Briefly on the benefits issue, I just want to add that in the case of coal generators, when they receive benefits, that is when they are using the grid, taking power off the grid. In that case, they are paying a retail tariff, the standby rate, and are paying their appropriate share of the GMC through that rate. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.